You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, a special Hall of Fame edition of the Pipeline Podcast. We're usually looking forward to prospects that we'll be talking about in the future, and we'll do some of that today. But we're going to look back at Big Poppy, David Ortiz, elected to the Hall of Fame, and an interesting history if you look back at his early days in pro baseball. We'll talk about that a little bit. We have a great interview with Dave Jouse, who was scout with the Red Sox when David Ortiz went from the Twins to the Red Sox. He was instrumental in landing Big Poppy. Jonathan had a chance to talk to him, and we'll have that interview for you. We will then look ahead and talk about some prospects that we'll be talking about, we think, a couple years down the line in 2024. We do this every year. We look ahead a couple years and project who the biggest prospects will be 2 years from now. And we'll talk about some guys that we might be talking about even further down the road. The 2022 PDP League, Prospect Development Pipeline League, the top 25 participants for this year's league were announced in a special on MLB Network. Jim and Jonathan were part of that that special over the past weekend. So we'll talk about a couple of the players there, and we'll wrap up by answering some questions in the mailbag. So Jim and Jonathan, like I said, a little unusual for us to be jumping into the fray on Hall of Fame talk, but that is the news as we're recording this on Wednesday, the day after the announcement that David Ortiz, first ballot Hall of Famer. Just last week, we talked to Jesse Sanchez with the international signing period beginning. And, you know, as is always the case in the international signing period, some of the big money guys turn out, some of them don't. Some guys who sign for next to nothing pan out, some don't. Ortiz, one of those guys who signed for next to nothing. This was back in 1992, money not what it was, what it is today then, but still only $3,500 he signed for, just 10 days shy of his 17th birthday. At the time, known as David Arias, signed by the Mariners. And Jim, an interesting path for him through the minor leagues.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you go back and look at his minor league career, I remember the first time I heard of him, you know, and I was a Baseball America at the time. The first time I heard of him was when he was traded in the Dave Hollins trade to the Twins. And it's funny, if you go back and look at his minor league career, you know, he was a two-year rookie ball guy, which is usually not a great sign for, you know, making the Hall of Fame, especially when you're in the Arizona League at age 19. And then, you know, it's funny, like, I was at Baseball America, but there really wasn't a ton of prospect coverage at the time. And I think if there had been, like today, like if we had the prospect coverage today back when he was coming as a prospect, I think he would have been more heralded because he had 322 in the Midwest League with 18 homers, which is a really tough place to hit. I think it's the toughest place to hit in the minors. And then the next year he went out and hit 317 with 31 homers at age 21 and cameo in Minnesota by the end of the year. But, you know, he was never a top 100 prospect when we were doing those lists at Baseball America. But it was interesting. I went back. He made three of our top prospect lists in minor leagues. And, you know, he in the Midwest League, when he broke out in 1996 at age 20, he was number six on our list. And I chuckle because the five names ahead of him, I don't even know how many of these guys you'll recognize, but there was Valerio de los Santos was number one, followed by Jeff Leifer, Brian Simmons, Britt Reams, and Larry Barnes. So that was not a very distinguished group that we had ahead of him. We did have him two spots ahead of Josh Booty. And then the next year we had him, he split time between the Florida State League and the Eastern League. And we had him number four in the Florida State League. And that was a more representative list. We had Adrian Beltre number one, Ruben Mateo number two, and Eric Melton number three. Lance Berkman was also on that list as well. And then up in the Eastern League, he was number six on that list behind Mark Kotze, Derek Gibson, Jarrett Wright, Alex Gonzalez, and Preston Wilson. But I do think he was a little underappreciated at the time because he was essentially a bat only guy. I don't know that anybody was saying, "Oh, he's going to be a DH for most of his career at that point." But you know, it's tough with those guys who all they do to hit is hit. They really have to hit, and I think he was a little underappreciated. Although the interesting thing, looking back at his stats, he had a 3-1 strikeout to walk ratio his last year in the minor leagues. He was not nearly the disciplined hitter he would become. So, I mean, you could see signs that, you know, there was a slugger in there, but I don't think anybody was tabbing him as a Hall of Famer coming up through the minors.
No, I would agree with that. You know, it's been interesting because I've been slowly digging into sort of his origin story for something I'm going to be writing later on. You know, you mentioned that year in the Midwest League with, you know, the Mariners where, you know, he hit 322 and he also drove in 93 runs. He had a 901 ops that year. And, you know, a combination of staff on the Twins, you know, the Twins had had an affiliate in the Midwest League. It was Fort Wayne at the time. So the, you know, members of that team staff saw Ortiz, or he was still David Arias then. And then scouts also. So, you know, when they were looking to shop Dave Hollins, you know, and it was a good fit because the Mariners needed a third baseman, and Woody Woodward was trying to, you know, put the final pieces to the, you know, that team that would end up being, you know, a very good team in the next couple of years. The Twins really kind of looked at Ortiz as well. This guy's got some offensive potential. And then, you know, the next year he started the year in Fort Myers, and went from Fort Myers to the big leagues. So he had a huge year in 97. He drove, you know, hit 31 homers and drove in 124 runs across three levels of the minors. Also hit 327 in 15 games in the big leagues. And that started his big league career. You know, I think a lot of attention gets put on what happened after that, in terms of him landing with the Red Sox, which allowed him to become a Hall of Famer. I think if he had stayed with the Twins, we wouldn't be talking about him as a Hall of Famer right now, because of how that ballpark was built, the AstroTurf, different things that, you know, sort of hurt his offensive output. Fenway Park was just a perfect ballpark for him to hit in.
A really fun story from that 1996 season when he was in Wisconsin in the Midwest League. Rob Terranova wrote a story a couple of years ago on MILB.com about a kind of impromptu home run derby. So back then, when Ortiz, then Arias, was in the Mariners system, the Mariners used to send their big league team to play against their affiliates in exhibition games. And they had gone to Appleton, Wisconsin in July of that year to play. And there was a huge storm and the field was in terrible shape. And, the Mariners were not going to send their players out there under those conditions. Lou Piniella, was vehemently against it. But they had all these fans there, you know, all these Mariners fans in the Midwest wanting to see these big leaguers. And so they came up just on the spot with, well, let's have a home run derby. Piniella was amenable to it. So they had Griffey Jr., A-Rod, and at the time the Mariners catcher Dan Wilson as the three competitors for the Mariners. Now, low A ball in the Midwest League, guys were not hitting the ball out there. They had Arias, who was the obvious choice. And then they had another player, was it Tinoco? Luis Tinoco, who was second on the team in homers. And the pickings were so sparse that their third competitor was the team's hitting coach, Joaquin Contreras. But apparently, Ortiz just stole the show as how old would he have been? 20 years old at the time. And, you know, Griffey Jr. and A-Rod, well established as stars at that point. And he just stole the show that day. And I think, you know, those guys were well aware of who he was at that point, even though it was years until he actually became a household name. Jim, you said that, I think before we came on, you said that at some point A-Rod had said that he had told the Rangers that they should sign Ortiz when he was cut loose.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know. I mean, you know, it's kind of like, you know, everybody has stories with Mike Trout, like, hey, we almost drafted Mike Trout. So I don't know how close it was. But yeah, A-Rod said, I was reading, you know, there's 8 million David Ortiz stories today, and I was reading a few of them, and I forget
you read, them
I read
all.
That one. But yeah, he said he made a pitch to the Rangers at the time that they should sign him, but was not listened to, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it took Ortiz quite a while to establish himself, and in large part due to injuries. If you look back at the beginning of his big league career, mentioned that he skyrocketed from high A all the way to the big leagues in 1997. Then 1998 had a fractured wrist. 1999 a torn ACL that derailed his September call up. In 2000 another. In 2000 that was the last time that he played more than 45 games. In the field in his professional career, played 111 games at first base for Salt Lake. But then in 2001, another fractured wrist. 2002, surgery to remove bone chips from his knee. You know, very difficult to overcome all those injuries. And then DFA'd in December of 2002, and that's where our friend Dave Jouse came into play. And we will take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear from Dave Jouse, who is now senior advisor for the Nationals in the player development department, then was Red Sox advanced scout who had a lot to do with David Ortiz ending up with the Red Sox. We'll take a break, come back with that interview right after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jonathan Mayo, happy to welcome in a special guest, now a senior advisor, the Washington National, David Jouse. Dave, thank you for taking some time out. Obviously, you know, we generally talk about prospects on this podcast, but everyone is all abuzz, you know, with the Hall of Fame talk, and, you know, wanted to sort of talk to you because you were an integral part of David Ortiz joining the Boston Red Sox. So I guess the first question, and granted, he was no longer a prospect, but he still was, you know, younger and an unknown quantity a little bit. But when did you first know about David? Was it, you know, when he got to the big leagues and you were scouting, or did you know who he was before then?
Well, because the and first of all, thank you. And thank you for saying I was an integral part. We're all small parts. And the best thing about all these things is players get recognized for what they do, both on the field and off the field. And that's David is great for the industry. He was great for Boston, but he's really good for the entire world's baseball industry, because he is a spokesperson. I'm not only carrying the bat, but just walking through stands, through towns, through cities, through his country in Dominican. And that's where I got to know him, both in the Dominican and in when he was with Minnesota, being in spring training against him in Fort Myers when he was in Minnesota in spring training and I was with the Red Sox in Fort Myers. We both got to play each other a whole bunch of times, got to play each other again when I was coaching during the season when he was with the Twins. And then I had an opportunity in 98-99 to manage in the Dominican against him. And that was some kind of right side for Escajito of the infield. It was David Ortiz at first and Rafael Furcal at second. He couldn't play short because Nefi Perez was the shortstop. He was the veteran in that time. So Furcal had to break in. And coming over to the Dominican, one of the interesting things was I showed up in the Dominican and on the bulletin boards, it wasn't the face of Pedro or Sammy Sosa or anything. It was David Ortiz advertising the local chicken place or the cell phone, because his face was the face of the Dominican down there. And he was the face of the winter ball. And so I had to play against him the whole time. And then in 99, we went to the Caribbean Series and we beat him and the Escajito team in a 9-game championship round that was supposed to be 7, but they extended it to 9 because they were making so much money. I was able to take him to Puerto Rico and he was the one that hit the walk-off hit. It wasn't a walk-off, it was the top of the 13th, but he drove in a run to beat Al Newman's, the team from Puerto Rico in the Caribbean Series. So I got to know him really well playing against him all those years. And then the week he went to Puerto Rico with us and he played for us.
Right, right. It's always fun. I covered a Caribbean Series once and it's always fun how you can pick up players along the way, you know, the Caribbean Series. So you knew him about as well as you're going to know a player when the Twins released him. What was your role with the Red Sox at that time?
I was the advanced scout. I had started the season as the farm director and then moved into advanced scout for Grady Little, and the team that was run by Grady Little, the major league club. And because I had gone from farm director to advanced scout, I was able to go to the Dominican and manage again against David for Lissay. He was with Escajito. Right away that day that he was let go by Minnesota, he and I hit each other. We'd had forged a relationship already. And he had forged so many relationships, but so right away I said, oh my gosh, this is some kind of player, for the Red Sox. There were some things that went on in Minnesota. He had to play on turf and that turf was nasty in Minnesota. It was terrible for his knees. He would come to Escajito and play right away all winter, play first base and never take a day off. And those games, even when it's 2-1, they last 4.5 hours. There's music in between innings and just games go on forever. And he played all the time. So I really believe that him DH and getting off the turf, DH and more, getting off the turf more would help his knees. He always had the rap that he didn't hit lefties. Well, in the Dominican, you have 14 bullpen guys every day and they're new every day. It's a rotating roster. And yet when I didn't have 5 or 6 lefties, I felt like I was handcuffed. And so every time he faced a different lefty from the 6th inning to the 9th inning every night, and he hit him. And then all of a sudden, the Metrodome was shorter in right field, and left center field was monstrous. And so he was trying to be a dead pole hitter in Minnesota, and being able to be in Fenway with hitters like Reggie Jefferson, Hatterberg, Veritek, when he switch hitter, of course, Jaron Bragg, Troy O'Leary, and the best of all those guys was Mo Vaughn. And they were such good hitters as left-handed hitters because the wall was so friendly to them. It allowed them to use the middle of the field, which David did when he was in the Dominican. He used the middle of the field. And so all those things said that he had an opportunity to be a really instrumental player for us in getting a championship.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, sort of it took a village. I know you were beating the drum for him. I talked to Theo. He was a player of interest to begin with. I want you to take me through the now sort of famous workout you put him through. Because I guess the one question was, why are they releasing him? Is there something wrong with the guy? So you know, what you did was not typical for a guy who is already an established major leaguer. You know, what was the discussion with, you know, your bosses at the time, and how did you decide, like, all right, we really need to put him through his paces? You know, it sounds like you were already convinced, but maybe, you know, you needed to help convince some others.
Well, yeah, I was already convinced, but I've been wrong on 350 players also, and been right on a few. And that's what scouting is about. So I understood that you work people out. And even though myself from the dugout as the opposing manager saw him playing every day, there was more affirmation from the office in Boston to get his, see how healthy he was. And especially because they had some players already signed for the role that he would ideally be in, not being a you know, part-time player, bench player, something along those lines. And so because of our relationship, and it wasn't just me, it was me and two of my coaches, Nelly Norman and Guadalupe Habalera, Jay Alou was the Dominican scouting director at that time. And you know, his relationship with myself, because of the Alou family being so close with me, he was there. Louis Alhawa, I had just gotten to meet. He had just come over to the Red Sox from the Marlins. And so all those guys said, well, we're around, we can work it out. And of course, Joust, you ask them. And so because of my relationship with David, because of, you know, the ability that all of us coaches have in relating to players, I was able to tell David that, hey, this is one part of the things that we have to check off. And so, and I think it was at 9 a.m. It might've been at 10 a.m., but I think it was at 9 a.m. And he was playing somebody at 8 o'clock that night in a round robin game. But at 9 a.m., he comes out to the field, and it's, you know, it's January in the Dominican, and it's already 96 degrees out. And at that time, Quisqueya was a really nice stadium for the Dominican, but it's not really a good field. I mean, it's, and the groundskeepers are dragging it for us, because I have a good relationship with them. Also the groundskeepers, and we're hitting ground balls to him. He doesn't have to hit at that time, but he has to run the bases. He has to take ground balls. He's sweating profusely, and he's, Jossie, what am I doing here? I said, just let's check this box off. And it was, you know, but the scouts were there in the stands, that the, you know, Jay and Louie, and there might've been another person there. And they're sweating too. Everybody did their part in their role to be there. And it was something that we could check off, and David, you know, as the man he is, you know, sucked it up, played really good that night also. And, it was a small part, but it was an important part. And I understand why Theo and Josh and those guys had to do it. Because as I told a guy last night on an interview, we're talking about David because of David, because there are those 350 or 400 or 500 guys that I recommended to be big league players that are now, you know, working at, you know, car salesmen or teachers or tremendous dads and husbands, but not playing baseball.
Right. I talked to Terry Ryan, and you know, I tried to give him the out, say that it was just a financial decision. And you know, Terry, he's not going to make an excuse. He just said, I just made a mistake. Were you surprised at all that they just out released him? I mean, Terry worked for a very long time trying to find a trading partner, including talking to Theo and the Red Sox to try to trade him. You know, I guess smartly Theo, you know, Terry told Theo that, well, if I can't find a trading spot for him, we're probably just going to release him. So they played the waiting game. But, you know, were you surprised that happened?
Yes. But I've been surprised, you know, I was surprised, but I've been surprised by so much more. And then because of being, knowing him in my dugout in 99, because being in Boston and seeing, and I, you know, there's a comp to Mo Vaughn. Mo Vaughn was some kind of player in Boston. If Mo Vaughn doesn't fall down the steps in Anaheim, we could have been having this talk about Mo Vaughn 10 years ago. He was that good a player and that productive a player in Fenway. That also type of teammate. Two of the best teammates and teammates for other, for the and industry people were Mo Vaughn and David Ortiz in Boston. And so seeing those things, yes, it did surprise me. And I love Terry Ryan and to this day, Terry Ryan and Smith and those guys that were with Minnesota that time. I remember that even before the David Ortiz thing, when they were trading Knoblauch to New York, they got Christian Guzman and he was playing shortstop with me. And it was a really good discussion on if they wanted Christian Guzman or D'Angelo Jimenez. And so the history that we had with Terry, let's talk about the really good move of getting Christian Guzman, not D'Angelo Jimenez, rather than talking about Ortiz.
Sure. Obviously, it's relevant to right now. Yeah, so
And so, but yeah, David, I was surprised. And that's the reason he and I connected right away down there in the Dominican the day afterwards. And he kept connecting with me because, yes, there was plenty of reasons why both Terry had to release him, Minnesota had to release him, and also why all sorts of other people, because as much as we look at it now, he became the player because of everybody that impacted him and his work and his abilities, and they weren't where they were supposed to be at that time. I was surprised, and he would drive by me because I walked to the ballpark every day. And I walked with my kids to the ballpark every day. We were homeschooling, so they were down in the Dominican. And he would honk in his big car. He'd be yelling out, "Hey, Chelsea, when are you guys going to sign me?" I said, "Hey, hold on. Theo and Josh Burns are going to get it done. Just wait. Henry's signing off on something." So it was kind of neat. It's a neat story.
Yeah, no, it's great. I wanted to ask about the specific car because I was reading about that, you know, that he kind of pulled you over. And there are other teams were interested in signing him. Do you know who those teams were?
I was strictly the manager of Lassay, the advanced scout for the Red Sox that wanted the Red Sox to win a ring, actually for Grady Little. I wanted to win the ring the following year for Grady Little and knew David Ortiz could help us doing that. So I had no idea. And I did get information on a little tidbit on what David would sign for, and I passed that on. And if they had signed that, if they had taken that offer that David had told me he would sign for, it would have helped them for 4 years financially on David also. So it hit them worse like 2 years later when they had to bump it up a little bit more than the 3 or 4 years he was asking me at that time.
I think there are probably no regrets on that end.
Not at all at
this point. All right. So no tea to spill on who the other teams that were interested. I couldn't find out who the teams that Terry were trying to trade him to. So it sounds like he spoke to just about everybody about that. But Jossie, you've been in this game for a long time, and you've hinted about all the guys that you were wrong on and things like that. But it's pretty clear the pride that you take in your part in this story, especially in this moment. Can you just sort of talk about how much it means to you that you sort of helped him get to the place he needed to be, not only to turn Boston into a winner, but then to eventually now have his plaque in Cooperstown?
Pride I have is that I love players, and the players' abilities as a player and as a man that then get recognized with achievements, rings, Hall of Fame, being good dads, being good husbands, being good friends, being, you know, all these things. That's what I love. And David, I remember Felipe always used the term, the man is better than the player, when he was evaluating a person, that evaluating a player. And David was always a better man than a player. And one of those times in one of those, when we were getting ready for one of the playoff series, and I brought in the advanced report and I given it to the whole staff. And then we had a dinner and I was leaving right after the dinner. I had to take a flight out to cover the next series. I was way in the background. Everybody else is dressed in their suits. And I got my gym shoes on so I can run through the airport and get to a flight. Sure enough, David comes in and brings me all the way up from the far back. I was back with the bullpen catcher and you know, maybe some of the AAA manager who was up at that time, something like that. He brings me up to the front table with John Henry and Lucchino and Theo and Burns and all these guys and says, you know, he puts his hand, his big paw on my head and says, yeah, this is one of the guys that got me here, right here. And that's, you know, it warms my heart that's the way he feels about people. And I'm one of those people.
Get to say that he was a better man. I mean, he's a pretty good player. So that's really saying something. A lot of people like to take a little credit, and rightfully so. You know, I know that Pedro Martinez definitely played salesman, probably in both directions, selling the Red Sox to David and vice versa. You know, were you guys like a tag team at a certain point in time? Yeah. Like, did you know that Pedro was kind of leaning on David also?
If we start talking about Pedro stories, that goes way back even more. Because I was advanced scout for the Expos when Tim Johnson and myself were, I just got a message from Dan Duquette, and he was instrumental in getting Pedro from the Dodgers to the Expos, and he really relied on Tim Johnson and myself. And so the relationship that I forged with Pedro through Dan, through Felipe Alou, did run through and continues to run through. He's our boys, all three of our sons who are in the game of baseball now, their favorite player always was Pedro. They were all three pitchers. And the youngest one even used a glove for Pedro when he was in high school and even start college. So Pedro and I are close. I can't say we tag teamed him at all, but I knew what he was doing because he was a lot more impactful with maybe John Henry and Larry Lucchino than David Jouse was.
I threw that in just so we could, you know, name drop another Hall of Famer that you came in contact with for you. So you're welcome.
Another special man. And it's the men that are different. I'm in this game and been blessed to be in this game because of the men and people, because it's not just men, but man, that I've been able to be blessed to be with.
All right, Dave. I mean, I think we could probably talk for hours. We'll save that for maybe for another episode, but we appreciate the time and we'll be right back with more of the MLB Pipeline podcast when we come back.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline podcast. Big thanks to Dave Jouse for taking the time to join us today. That was a very enjoyable look back at a young David Ortiz. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. Now we're going to turn our attention to the future, a couple years into the future. Last week, we did a story where we looked back at how we had looked forward in 2020 looked forward to prospects we'd be talking about in 2022, kind of determined how right or wrong we were in looking at a prospect for each team that would be generating a lot of buzz right around this time. And we're going to do the same thing now for 2024. We're going to look ahead and see who those prospects will be. Jim and Jonathan, you've each picked a player, a couple of players each, from a couple of your teams that you think will be making noise around this time in 2 years. Jonathan, you're only going to pick guys with the same last name as you?
Yes, that's it. It's all right. Somewhat limited.
Well, let's hear them.
Not both of my guys for this.
No, that's true. That's true.
Diego Mayo. Mayo is his mother's name, so he's Diego Mayo.
He's going to change it.
Exactly.
He's going to change it in a few years, like David Arias. So Kobe Mayo, my nephew. No, he's not actually related, but I will continue to say that. From the Orioles, is an interesting guy because we didn't get a chance to see him as much as we may have liked in 2021. He had some injury issues, but he has tremendous raw power. Did get to some of it in the time he played. He only played in 26 games last year, but managed to spend a good amount of time, most of that time in, 27 games total, but he spent a good amount of that time in full season ball where he slugged .547. There's some swing and miss there. He's big and strong, right-handed hitter. Maybe an Austin Riley type. Troy Glaus is another comp we've been getting, but like the power is what really plays. He's got a really strong arm. I think he'll have work to do to stay at third just because he's so big. But I'm excited to see him have a healthy full season. He's still super young. He'll be 20 for all of the 2022 season. So I think in a couple years now, he may be one of the better power hitters in the minor leagues. Am I going straight back to back with my other non-Mayo category?
Snake draft, Jim, or are we?
Well, we're not drafting. Either way, I thought you set him up to talk about both his guys. So
we did.
I'll keep going then. The other guy I think was kind of interesting, and I may this may be pushing it because this is a guy who just signed in the with the start of the international signing period a couple weeks ago. But it's noteworthy because he was signed by the Braves, and as has been well documented, the Braves were kind of on the sideline for a good length of time following the penalties that they for international signing infractions. So this is the first year that they've been all in with their full bonus pool, and they went out and signed Diego Benitez, the Venezuelan shortstop, to a bonus of $2.5 million. He was number 10 on our international prospects list, our top 50 put together by Jesse Sanchez. He's gotten some Manny Machado comps. He's got really good bat speed, good power, pretty good overall approach, but the discipline will have to come. We'll see, whether he, stays at shortstop. It's so, who knows, but he's got good hands and he runs well and a strong arm. So you give him every chance to be at short, and people aren't afraid of bigger shortstops at this point anyway. But a lot of offensive upside there. Will he be like, a high level elite prospect in 2024? Maybe, if it's 2025, then, we can say we were ahead of the curve.
All right, Jim, no calluses out there for you to choose from.
None that we know of. But, I went with Angel Martinez of the Indians is one of my two guys. And I feel like I've been writing about him. He's been on our Indians list for a couple of years, and he's still just 19. He will actually turn 20 tomorrow. And he's been a favorite in the Indians organization for a while. Signed in 2018 out of the Dominican. He's the son of former big league catcher Sandy Martinez. And I know it's a cliche, but it seems like all these guys who have, dads who played in the big leagues or coached or whatever, grow up around the game, they have a high baseball IQ, but Angel Martinez has a high baseball IQ. Like, he's, you know, probably only an average to solid runner, but he plays quicker than that at shortstop. He's got a solid arm. He gets rid of the ball. He's got that great internal clock. He's a switch hitter. He's got an advanced approach. You know, I think he's going to hit for average. I don't think he's going to be a big slugger, but I think he can be a 12 to 15 home run guy, steal a few bases. He's part of that never-ending pipeline of middle infielders that the Guardians have. I think on our current list, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, I think 5 infielders are in the Guardians top 10, and it might be 15 of their top 30. So they're loaded. Angel Martinez is another one along those lines. And then for the Rangers, the guy I wanted to spotlight was Evan Carter, who was one of the bigger surprises in the 2020 draft. Wasn't really on my radar at all as a Tennessee high schooler, and he went in the second round and signed for $1.25 million. And at the time, I went back and did some follow-up after the Rangers drafted him and talked to all the area guys I talked to in Tennessee. And a couple of them had him on their radar. Most teams didn't. He was more of a guy they would have tried to go see that spring had they had time, and there really wasn't much of a high school season. And the Rangers, were on him more than anybody. They'd done a lot of work. They felt like they had to take him that high to get him away from a commitment to Duke. And they really emphasized, look, we think this guy's got five-tool potential. And he does have really interesting tools. But I think what really stood out in his pro debut this year was his aptitude and polish for a high school kid. Now, he had a stress fracture in his back that ended his season earlier, but he was really controlling the strike zone very well, used the whole field. Very exciting for the Rangers that it wasn't just, okay, here's some raw tools, but this guy could develop even quicker than they think. They like the intangibles too. The intelligence, he's got great instincts, he's got tremendous makeup. I think he was valedictorian of his high school class. So there's a lot to like about Evan Carter. And it looks like, it's early. I mean, he's only played 32 games in pro ball. But for a guy who a lot of teams were surprised when he went in the second round, he's really raised his profile.
Not only will we be talking about these guys in 2024, but Jim promises to get the Cleveland organization team name right by then also.
I think I said Guardians at one point, but I probably did throw
it. You did. You self-corrected, but I still have to tease you.
It's early. Yeah, I think that's a good prediction for 2024.
Yep.
We will, in addition to those four prospects, we will have one prospect for each team that we look forward to talking about in 2024 when they're making buzz. That story will be up on MLB.com/pipeline a little later this week.
And to clarify one thing, Jason, for added degree of difficulty, we're not picking players who are currently on the top 100 prospects list.
That's right. I meant to.
There are some who have 2024 ETA, like Jason Dominguez for the Yankees, obviously. But we're not picking. If they're on the top 100, we're deeming that too obvious a choice.
There we go. Okay, so let's look ahead, perhaps even a little bit further down the road. You guys were on MLB Network special this past week on the 2022 PDP League participants. So these are 2023 draft prospects, high school draft prospects. The PDP League will be taking place later this summer, and they have invited 25 of the top high school prospects from the 2023 draft class to participate in that league, which has already in its early stages proven to be host to some of the almost all of the really elite high school prospects across the country. 25 really interesting kids that we'll be hearing about in next year's draft class. For now, for our purposes here on the podcast, why don't you guys tell us about what I guess are the consensus top hitting and pitching prospects in that class?
Yeah, and they'll invite more players too. I think there'll be 90-something when all is said and done. They'll split them into four teams, and they'll do some training and play some games. I want to say the dates are June 29th through July 5th. It'll be before the draft this year. It'll end about a week before the draft. But as of now, the consensus number one high school prospect in the country for 2023 is Max Clark, who's from Franklin, Indiana. He's committed to Vanderbilt, but looks like he's going to go very high in the draft and not make it to Nashville. And I mean, I don't know if there's really a hole in his game right now. I think he's the most advanced hitter in that 2023 class. He's got a mature approach. He's got a lot of hard contact. The power's developing. I think we're talking about a 20 to 25 home run guy when all is said and done. He's run the 60 in sub 6.5 seconds, so he's a plus-plus runner. He covers a ton of ground center field. He has a solid-to-plus arm out there, which is unusual for a center fielder. He's up to 92 on the mound as a left-handed pitcher, even though he's a hitter all the way. He's kind of like a speedier version of Jared Kelnick at the same stages of their career. So he really, really intrigues me. And, you know, as of now, I mean, look, a lot can change between now and July 2023, but Max Clark's a top high school player in the country and would be a candidate to go number one overall.
You know, it's interesting that like the two top guys are from, you know, cold weather states, Clark from Indiana. Right now, consensus may be pushing it a little bit, but Thomas White, who's from Massachusetts, a lot of people think has a chance to be the best high school arm. And if you do a little research into history, the history of high school arms from Massachusetts, is, you know, or even from New England overall, not a particularly rich history, but he does check off a lot of boxes. He's left-handed. He's 6'5". He's already touching 95, can spin a breaking ball, has shown some feel for a changeup. The one thing that he hasn't done is he hasn't really been seen a lot and hasn't thrown a ton. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's a good thing given that, you know, these are guys that are starting their junior year of high school. We were talking off the air that, you know, because of the pandemic, these are players who've really only played 1 year of high school baseball. So I think the gloves are going to start to come off. You'll see them, you know, more of the showcase events, especially, you know, this one in the PDP league, and that will put him even further on the map. He pitched at a showcase at Fenway Park in the fall and was just absolutely lights out. I think he touched a 96 there, you know, briefer look. So there's a lot to like. I think there's just, you know, question marks because he hasn't been seen in too many events, you know, to date. But I think anytime you have a lefty who is projectable and already has now velocity with ease, there's not a lot of effort in his delivery. People are going to be very, very excited.
And Jim, you were right. The PDP League will run from June 29th to July 6th this year. In addition to just the league itself and the great experience that provides these players, additionally, it serves as the primary identification series for USA Baseball's 18U national team. So approximately 40 players will earn an invitation to those team trials to vie for a spot on the final roster. And then that team will compete in the World Baseball Softball Confederation U18 Baseball World Cup, which is going to be held in Bradenton and Sarasota this year. That's going to run from September 9th through the 18th.
And it'll probably be, I mean, I would suspect because it's now going to be before the draft this year, they'll also use it again as the feeder program for the high school futures game that they held the weekend of the futures game in the draft, which will be Dodger Stadium next year. So we'll probably see a lot of those guys in LA a couple days before the draft.
Another not so bad perk for them. All right. Let us wrap this up by answering some questions in the mailbag. Had a pretty good selection of questions to choose from this week. We will start with this one from Kevin Carpenter, who we should answer this question if for no other reason for his Twitter handle of Church Pew Pew Pew. Kevin asks, which college baseball players ranked outside the top 100 draft prospects has a chance to finish in the top 30 with a strong year, a la Trevor Larnach or Jonathan India in 2018? I'm rooting for Colby Halter and Trey Faltine.
You were rooting for them, Jason? Or
no, no, that's the, that's
okay. I didn't know if you were rooting for those guys in particular.
No, that's I was really guy. Hoping that
you're a
you
big
were
fan of the Longhorns, right?
And the Yankees.
I was hoping that you would have really gotten into reading his Twitter handle. Yeah, and just done like a to... church pew 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 like that. That would have been better.
I left it for you.
Okay, thank you. So I'm gonna. Colby Hoelter is an interesting one. I think he's one of these like good baseball player types at the University of Florida. But I'm actually going to pick a different Florida Gator, and that's Josh Rivera. Mostly because he has the chance to stick at shortstop. He's gotten in excellent shape. Scouts are very impressed in meetings with him. Even if he moves to third eventually, you know, he can really hit. Even if he slides over, it might fit the profile well there. So I think, you know, since you mentioned Jonathan India, we'll stick with a Florida Gator, but rather than Colby Hoelter, I'm going to say, Josh Rivera, because I think Hoelter may profile more as a, like a super utility guy when all is said and done. Maybe he's a second baseman. Rivera with the chance to play on the left side of the infield. I'll give him the edge there.
I like the question. It's a tough one because if we actually felt that any of these guys had a good chance to be a first round pick, they would have made the top 100. The top two high school guys who missed for me were a pair of outfielders, Amarian Boyd from Mississippi and Tommy Speck from Iowa.
You didn't ask about high school guys. What are you doing?
I thought he said, he said college baseball players. I was going to say I was thinking players and I was going to go college. So
I had some high school guys.
Not reading the question.
Bonus.
Yeah, no. What I was going to say is I'm not going with those guys because I was going to say if it was just players, I think the question is better suited for a college player because the high school guys are more raw, and I think that works up against them going in the first round. So I was circling back to a college player, even though my listening skills
I'll help focus you a little bit.
Well, we're not very good there. I'm sorry about that. But I'm going to go with TJ McCants of Ole Miss, who's an outfielder. Had a really nice freshman year. Super toolsy. His brother was a high pick last year. And you do get some mixed reports on him. I mean, there's some guys who really like him. They like the athleticism, the back-to-ball skills. They think he's going to stick in center field. They think there's some projectable power. He can really run. You know, the reason he didn't quite make our list is there's other guys who worry a little bit about the bat and the strike zone discipline and the power and all that. But I do think if it comes together and he did exceed expectations last year, if he can continue to develop like that, I could see TJ McCants as a toolsy guy who plays up the middle. He's played some infield. I don't think he can really play second base, but as a toolsy guy, he plays up the middle. And he's going to be in the SEC facing, you know, the best competition in the country. If he comes out and has a really good year, I could see TJ McCants going in the first round.
It's funny, by the way, because I first picked out a high school player and then reread the question and realized that that's what they were looking for.
All right, let's move on to a question that hopefully will be less confusing for the two of you. This is from Aaron Bresick, B-R-E-C-E-K, Bresick, at Bresick24. Which prospect or prospects outside of the top 100 do you see moving up the list the most throughout the season and going into next year? So this is the top 100 prospects overall, not the draft prospects list. So a similar question with a different list.
Yeah, it's funny because Marlins fans will be like, this guy should be on your top 100 already. And he's not. He will be on the new top 100. But I'll go with Eury Pérez of the Marlins. You know, we seems like we've talked about him a few times on the podcast because he's just so interesting. But he's, you know, a guy who's gotten a lot bigger and a lot better since the Marlins signed him a couple of years ago out of the Dominican Republic. He's now 6'8", 200, a lot of room to add more strength, but his fastball's gone from the mid 80s when the Marlins first saw him to now it's 93, 96 and topping out at 98. And there's room to add more velocity, but even better than that, just the shape of his fastball and the running life up in the strike zone and the induced vertical break. I mean, that might be a 70 or 80 pitch when all is said and done. And he's got a really nice changeup that's going to be a plus pitch, mid 80s, fade and tumble. He's got an upper 70s curveball that he lands for strikes. It could get a little sharper. That might be a plus pitch. And even though he's this big gangly guy, he's got tremendous body control. He throws strikes, really mature for his age. He got to high A last year as an 18-year-old. And, you know, had we had a couple more guys graduate, he was in a group of guys we're talking about adding to the list at the end of the season. But I think Eury Pérez is going to shoot up the top 100. And I don't know if he wants this honor, because it seems like whoever we rank is the best pitching prospect in baseball. Like, there's the Forrest Whitleys, the Mackenzie Gores of the world have fallen on hard times. I think Nate Pearson was our guy last year and he got hurt. But I think a year from now, Eury Pérez might be in the discussion for the best pitching prospect in baseball if he continues to develop like he has in his first year in the minor leagues.
I'm going to go the position player route on this one. I'm going to take Elly De La Cruz of the Reds. Nice. It was a guy who kind of almost came out of nowhere, which is rare. Did not sign for a lot of money. Got $65,000 back in July of 2018, was fine during the Dominican Summer League in 2019, but certainly not anything that, made people sit up and take notice. And, people put up some pretty gaudy numbers in the DSL. But then he came to the United States, and I remember talking to the Reds about him. He was an addition when someone graduated last year, because basically right out of the gate in spring training and then in the Arizona Complex League, he was clearly just too good. Hit for average and for power, and they couldn't promote him fast enough. And he made it up to full season ball to finish off his United States debut. And he can do a lot of things really, really well. Ton of bat speed. He's a really good athlete. He's gotten stronger. He's a switch hitter. He made strides in his approach, so I think he's going to get better at that. Not, some uncommon for a really young player. He may be a plus hitter with plus power when all is said and done. He thinks of himself as a big league shortstop. He has the arm and defensive actions to do it. He's played some third. They could run him out in center field because of his plus speed. So, obviously he's got a long way to go and he'll need to prove it as he, moves up the ladder. But, this is a guy who, even when talking to scouts from other teams, people are very excited about what he did last year.
All right. Thanks very much, Aaron, for that question. And thank you, Kevin, for yours as well. And again, thanks very much to Dave Jouse for joining us on this episode of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. That's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.